IATSE 891 presents Apple Box Talks, the podcast where we get to talk to the very best artists, technicians, and interest holders that make up the BC entertainment industry. From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes.
Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Hillary.
And I'm Crystal. Our guest today is one of the most respected voices in the Canadian motion picture industry. As IATSE International Vice President and Director of Canadian Affairs, John Lewis has spent decades fighting for the artists and technicians who bring film, television, and live performance to life behind the scenes. He's championed Canadian crews on Parliament Hill, broken new ground negotiating AI protections at the bargaining table, and built bridges with international organizations to lift standards across the global industry. But beyond these titles and wins, John is known for something more simple but significant, showing up for the IATSE membership every single time. John, welcome to the Apple Box.
Well, thank you for those very kind words as an introduction.
Well deserved, my friend. So we normally start with an origin story. Can you tell us how you got your start in labor?
Sure. So I grew up in Montreal. My father was a carpenter. He was a plasterer by trade. And we grew up as rough and tumble. I was the youngest of seven children. And I knew from a young age, labor was always sort of part of the conversation at the dining room table. It was during some very tumultuous times in Quebec, and my brothers were pushing the boundaries as to, you know, what younger people were trying to achieve then. And it was that sort of drive and that sort of discussion that kind of drove me both to, I did an undergrad at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia in business with a concentration in finance. I then went to law school at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto. And it was there that I knew it was just going to be labor for me. I knew it was going to be labor right from the get-go. And I never turned back. And it was always going to be union-sized labor. That was never a consideration. So when I finished Osgoode Hall Law School, I started practicing labor law, primarily in the construction industry in Toronto, representing a number of unions. And then I became, through a series of events, I was with the Carpenters Union. I was a big client of the law firm I worked for. And I became in-house counsel for one of the largest carpenter locals in Canada. And then I became the business manager, which is their equivalent of the president of that local for a period of time. And then after that, I became a vice chair of the Ontario Labor Relations Board. Because even when I was functioning as the de facto head of the Carpenters Union in Toronto, I was still doing a lot of the legal work because I didn't want to give up on the legal work. And so I then, really a big leap of faith, I became a vice chair of the Ontario Labor Relations Board, which is a quasi-judicial administrative tribunal like they have in BC. The Ontario Board is the largest in the country. I was a private arbitrator for a period of time. And then a gentleman by the name of Bernie Fishbane knocked on my door. Bernie was the former Canadian counsel for the IATSE. They were looking for someone to become the director of Canadian Affairs. He knew of my background, the fact that I worked in a management capacity with a union. I still had that fire in my belly in terms of representing people. I made that big jump to the IATSE, and that was 24 years ago, and I'm still here.
So what really compelled you? You said there was no question that you were going in labor's direction. You're clearly drawn to it. What's the reason?
You know, we grew up in Montreal. I won't say we were poor, but my parents had a very strict budget. We knew what we could and could not afford. I grew up with, not that it was a big deal, but powdered milk. For those who've never had the pleasure of having powdered milk, you'll know what I mean in terms of the clumps they get the other day. But it was the only way my parents could make it go. Mm-hmm. And we had to watch every dime. And seeing my father work, he built the house we lived in. And just seeing what he had to go through, and he wasn't treated badly, but just seeing what he had to go through, I knew I was, I had a kindred spirit for working people. It's funny because I had a number of colleagues that I went to law school with that would flip back and forth between management side or union side. To me, it was just never a question. It was always going to be union. You know, fighting for a pension, fighting for higher wages, health and safety, just seemed to make sense. I couldn't imagine being on the other side trying to stop people from getting a pension, stopping people from improving their health and safety.
You've got a fairly unique bird's eye view of how IATSE has grown and changed in Canada. What are some of the biggest shifts you've seen?
Well, let me just start off by saying one of the reasons I love working for this union is I am floored by the skill set of our members. I didn't work in the industry. I'm a lawyer. I will go to sets. I will see what our people can create. And I'm sure I become a safety concern because I'm floored by what I see. And I'm stunned by it. And knowing that that takes place, that creative workforce that takes place with such tight timelines and what happens to our members in terms of trying to produce so quickly and on time, on budget, I'm fascinated by what our people do. And I never forget that. And so that always helps to motivate me. In terms of an organization, so when I started, Tom Short was the international president. He was a revolutionary in a lot of ways. He brought in more industry-wide collective agreements to use our leverage as employers used it against us, you know, to stop the days of employers, large multinational employers, taking on local unions one by one. That's an unfair fight. And so we brought in the concept of the Hollywood Basic Agreement, the Area Standards Agreement, what's happened in BC, you know, in terms of being able to bring the economic might and leverage of working people so we can match and we can speak at a level playing field with the employers in this industry. That is crucially important. And so the biggest change I have seen is a recognition that we have to do things differently in order to exert that economic influence to protect our members. And I see that every single day. I think the other thing that I've seen is just, we're not there yet, but I've seen effort to recognize that we are a very homogeneous union, very white, very male. And we're not there yet, but I see real efforts, not just cheap talking points. I see effort being used to really take on the issues, that diversity. I look at the hair and makeup side letter for 891. Those are tough discussions to have, but I think those are good discussions to have, and it makes us all a little bit stronger by having those discussions. And we're not there yet. But I've seen such a change in the culture of this organization. And people ask me, you know, what are the great achievements of the IA? And people usually look to contracts and organizing successes. I look at what we've done in terms of making people feel at home working for their union, working in their union. And we're not there yet, but I think we've made great strides.
Yeah, I think you got where I was hoping you would get to quite quickly, which is awesome in terms of like that so often we talk about IATSE or larger union bodies or larger labor groups as kind of an amorphous blob of power, but really boiling it down to the fact that it's not possible without individual members coming together to move in that solidarity. But that can be really difficult when you're not in the majority in the room or you're from a group that hasn't necessarily always felt like they've had a voice. So like, how would you frame your bird's eye view to encourage those members that are in experiencing that we're not there yet feeling?
So, you know, we're an organization that believes in local autonomy. It's, and again, we mean it. it becomes, it's not always easy though. So we, you know, it really means grassroots power in the membership with their local unions. And really that's where everything comes from. But it also means we're not always on the same page. And some locals may be going off in the right direction, according to my view, and some may not be going off in the right direction. And so how do you, without being too forceful, how do you promote the locals that are doing the right things as an example without being too condemning to the locals that aren't? And because, you know, you don't know where they're coming from and where they're going, sort of thing. But we've seen it. We've seen locals make big strides. This is, you know, 891 is one of them. It's about being patient. But are you then, question, are you being too patient? And where do you draw the line? Because if you push, as an international, we have like 350 local unions. If you push too hard, because it really has to come from the ground up. It really does. People look at the international, we've made great strides in our own staffing to try to be somewhat more diverse, but we tend to hire from our local unions. And so if there isn't that diversity at the local level, it's that much more difficult for our hiring practice to reflect where we want to go in terms of diversity. So in some ways, it's an easy solution for the international to put an edict and say, we're going to do this and we're going to force everyone to do this. I don't know if that brings about real cultural change. I think the cultural change is when people themselves recognize that is the right thing to do and we should do it, I should do it, and it sort of becomes a little bit more organic in terms of a change. I think it means it's slower. It means sometimes you go off in different directions and maybe not always the right direction. But I think you get to a place that is stronger. And I think the changes take root and they're permanent.
Mm-hmm. We've seen that in our membership with Side Letter 17, the trainee program specifically, and members approaching us saying, we want to participate in this. And that shift from when we first introduced it to now, and also, you know, our REDI committee, which is made up of the voices of the membership. Really, it's from that kind of root, is what you're saying, that these changes can disseminate and really take hold and have that significant cultural shift.
Because it's about fear. People are afraid of change. And again, by not forcing it, but working with everybody, again, it might be a little bit slower, but then I think the change gets deep-rooted and entrenched.
So I want to switch gears a little bit here. We like to try to demystify bits and pieces of things that kind of operate in the background. And sometimes it can feel that way to membership. They don't really understand the international. It feels really big. It feels, you know, a bit nebulous sometimes, especially to people who don't have time to come to conventions and don't have the schedule that allows it. Tell us what you do, because you do a significant amount of one-to-one work with the locals, particularly with bargaining. But it's not just bargaining. You are a support for all of us in so many ways. And so paint a picture, day in the life of John Lewis for us.
Well, it's funny you ask that, because I ask that question of people all the time. Tell me what your typical Tuesday is. Let me just step back. So again, 350 locals. We have locals as large as 891, the largest local union in the IETSC. But then we have locals with 15 people, right? And so not every local has the same requirements for assistance, what they're looking for from the international. And so it's about matching what the needs of the local are by what we can deliver in terms of services. And that is sometimes is difficult to balance. And some locals just, they want to do their own thing, and we have to respect that if they want to do their own thing. And sometimes leadership changes, and so views changes. I would say, you know, my children used to ask me, Dad, what do you do? Because we're not really sure what you do for a living. You say you're a lawyer, but you're not really a lawyer anymore. And I used to say, I manage people's expectations. And they would look at me and go, that's bull. What does that even mean? But in some ways, I think we all manage people's expectations. I know in bargaining, that's a crucial piece to it. about what you can and cannot deliver on. There's always that fear of overselling. We do a lot of organizing. So you're asking me what I do. So I lead a team that primarily assists local unions in negotiations. Unfortunately, there is more and more lawyers, and I am a recovering lawyer, so I can say it, but there's more and more lawyers that are inserting themselves in collective bargaining, particularly in the film industry. The Hollywood studios, I think there's been a dramatic shift. It used to be labor relations dictated how the studios interacted with the workers and with the unions. The modern view of the studios now, these are tends to be lawyers, and they're more transactional, and there's less focus on relationships. And so because of that, you know, you come off the floor, you're a grip, you win an election, you think you have some things to say, you think you can deliver some good things for the union, and you're up against a room full, literally with the AMPTP, mm-hmm. as you know, Crystal, a room full of lawyers on the other side. That's a bit of a one-sided fight. But we always, so we provide that type of assistance, and sometimes it's just being in the room, letting the employer know the international's there. It's not this local on their own. There is an organization behind them. Sometimes it's taking the front seat on that, but sometimes it's just some quiet counsel. Here's what's happening in other jurisdictions. Here's how they do it in LA, in Toronto, in New York, and just to give some context, which is important. And to let the employer know that there's another entity here, sort of thing. So that is crucially. We give a lot of support to our locals in terms of just day-to-day administration. It's becoming more complex in terms of just running unions now, and to make sure that they do the right thing for the right reasons. And, you know, they sometimes say, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this was the right thing. Yeah, but you just set yourself up, because is that how you're going to deal with everybody on that situation? Yeah, we changed the rules because it made sense here. I get it. It makes sense. But now that is the expectation for everyone. And if it isn't, now you're in trouble, because there's an expectation that you will follow that same role, sort of thing. And then lobbying. And I know, Crystal, you have lots of experience there. The voice of the IA has never been stronger than it is right now. Federally, for years, we had no voice. We sort of took a backseat to ACTRA, the DGC, UBCP, would speak for the industry. And it wasn't too long I was in this job, and I'd look around and go, but what they're saying doesn't impact. No, that's not what my members want. Why do we listen to you? Shocking, I know, to some people that crew might not always have the same interests as the directors and or the actors. And we don't. And we're the largest. We're the largest. And so we have spent a considerable amount of time. We have a full-time lobbyist. We are in the halls of power in Ottawa all the time. The opinion of the IA is sought after. We are asked, what do you think about this? That takes time, because we're also reasonable. We don't chime in on every single issue that is being debated. We pick and choose those issues that are important to our members. Online Streaming Act, copyright, AI now, and what is happening. Those are areas that we are fully engaged on, and we will be fully engaged on. CUSMA, the Canadian-US-Mexico Free Trade Agreement, how the Online Streaming Act impacts it or not. Again, issues that directly impact our members, we are front and center. Other issues, and I'm not saying they're not important, public health care, some other issues, we just don't engage. There's a limit of resources in what you can do, but we're also trying to prioritize those issues which really directly impact the lives of our members.
So we'll dig into AI in just a second. I would love to talk about that hot button issue, the Online Streaming Act. Is there a way you can paint it for our members or for listeners in a way that's digestible, understandable? There's a position here, there's a position there, and why it is we take the position we take as the IA?
Yeah. There's a lot of hype about the Online Streaming Act. And a lot of people will like to wrap themselves in a Canadian flag and say it's about cultural sovereignty. And to an extent it is, but make no mistake, it's about money. So traditional broadcast is dying out in Canada. It's just not supporting revenue streams anymore with ads supported. Cable is dying out. People are cutting cable. So streaming is becoming where it is. The domestic industry has somewhat archaic funding models that are based on the traditional broadcast models. So that has to get changed. There are institutions which have never been very kind to British Columbia, by the way. When you look at where the funding for the Canadian Media Fund, where Telefilm goes, it's primarily, and I come from Toronto, a disproportionate amount goes to Toronto and Montreal. Very little comes out west. Very little goes out east. And so you're dealing with that. And so there's this new model. And so everyone thought, okay, we need to deal something with this Streaming Act. Streamers were not considered broadcasters under the Broadcast Act, so they were unregulated. Other countries have no problem with being unregulated, but Canada, we have a tradition of regulating, so we regulate. I think the Online Streaming Act did a lot of good things. One, it didn't set down hard and fast rules, and it allowed the CRTC to kind of explore and be flexible. When we appeared before the CRTC, we said a couple things. One is, do no harm. This is an incredibly competitive industry, and it's changing. Light speed changes. And so what you're dealing with today might not be relevant even 2 years from now. And we've seen that already. It's not the same. And do no harm. And do no harm. So the fight now is, how much money should U.S. streamers pay into the domestic industry? That's what it's really all about. Should there be some payment? I think there should be. What is the amount of that payment? I don't know. But, you know, if you're talking about an amount of money, reasonable people can usually come into a room and figure out what that number is. That's what we do all the time, right? Whether you're in a union setting with a contract or whether you're working, you're negotiating, you know, your kit rental. We're all trying to figure out a number. And so that's really where it is. You know, on the left, the domestic industry and, you know, a strong industry, you need a strong domestic industry and a strong foreign service industry. You need both. It's not one or the other. And I think I regret, because the industry has really devolved into a lot of finger pointing. And it's like we're two competing industries. That's not the case. If you're a crew member, you're just working. You don't care if it's a Canadian production or an American production. You just want to work and get paid and get benefits and have health and safety. So how much is enough? And that's really where it's coming down to. I get offended when I hear the U.S. streamers are freeloaders. They're taking advantage of their freeloading. Well, the biggest proportion of our industry is now U.S. production, foreign service, not just in B.C., but everywhere. Secondly, they're also, I think, the second largest investors in domestic production after provincial tax credits. So they're bigger than the CBC. They're bigger than all the other organizations. It's the U.S. streamers are putting money into domestic production. Again, it's about money. So all this is being played out. The CRTC made a ruling that we very much supported in terms of defining what is a Canadian content, because that's also part of the Online Streaming Act. There's requirements to fund Canadian product. And it used to have a very small 10 out of 10. There was a 10-point system that really neglected the crew. Now we were able to include positions like hair and makeup, keys, right? Wardrobe. They weren't included before. Female-dominated positions. Because the key is, because now there's more of an incentive to hire Canadians. Because if you hire a Canadian, you fit in the definition of Canadian, and then you get certain financial benefits to that. So all that is playing out. But then there's Mr. Trump, right? And he is, threatened the tariffs, which didn't make sense. But there are a lot of tools at the disposal of the President of the United States. If he wanted to inflict damage, he can. There are two main irritants to the United States government when it comes to Canada in terms of trade. One is the dairy industry, and we have the tariffs and protectionism. The other is online streaming. That is the second area that they're talking about. I don't know about you, but to me, this is the worst time to do anything with the Online Streaming Act, to impose funding obligations, if it's going to incur the wrath of the American president.
And that's what you meant by do no harm?
Do no harm, right? I'm not, and I think there is an ability, if we could just get people in the room, is it 3%? Is it 4%? Is it 5%? Let's work out a number.
Because this exists in other countries, right?
Yes. Yeah, it exists in other countries. And it's not like, oh, you have to pay 3%, now you're not going to produce. But put it this way, particularly in British Columbia, the largest foreign service location, right, in the country, that gets very little telefilm and very little Canadian Media Fund. So one of the obligations on the Online Streaming Act is the streamers would have to give so much, I think it's 1.5% of however you define certain revenue streams, to the Canadian Media Fund and Telefilm. So you're going to take studios that primarily shoot in BC, give them money to the historical institutions that never fund productions in BC. And we said this to the CRTC, how does that make sense? If you're from British Columbia, why would you ever support something that's going to take money away from the studios that come to British Columbia, that employ people at much higher rates, terms, and conditions than domestic does, to fund Telefilm and Canadian Media Fund so they can produce these things in Toronto and Montreal? I don't get it. And by the way, Telefilm, we're part of a large consortium that is going after Telefilm because they are increasingly funding non-union productions. So it makes it even worse. Mm-hmm. So studios only shoot union in Canada. So you're going to go a unionized, I won't say names, but a one of the U.S. streamers that typically comes to BC, you're going to take money away from them. So they go into these funding models that will not likely come to BC. And when wherever they shoot, they tend to shoot more and more non-union now. In what world does that make sense? Mm-hmm. In what world?
It certainly doesn't speak to the sustainability of the workforce, which after COVID and the strikes and the slowdown, we know is vitally important to tend to.
And it's funding the erosion of worker power.
All of it is. I'm shocked. I have two children that work in the industry. One, my son, is an 891 member. How they've been able to sustain themselves in an industry, even at the best of times, goes up and down. But when you add in COVID and everything else, and then the labor disruptions in the States, which may not be at an end, it takes a special kind of person to kind of persevere. And right? It's not like anything else.
I mean, so at the risk of then compounding that anxiety, the next big thing that you're talking about then is AI as our next existential threat as an industry. How do you see your role in that lobbying piece, especially federally, because that's very much how you're showing up for us? How are those conversations playing out in terms of how the voice of labor is being heard?
Or not being heard. and so in the opening, you mentioned international relations. So we're part of a group called UniMay, and it is a network of international unions, primarily in the creative industries. And it has a lot of Europeans, but it's everywhere, Asia, not so much in Africa, but Asia and South America. And you see firsthand the regard the rest of the world has for the IA, and I include Europe. What we were able to achieve with our collective agreements last cycle in terms of the start, and I want to emphasize that, the start of building protections for workers, for AI, the rest of the world is watching because they didn't get what we got in terms of notification, in terms of being able to sit down with your supervisor. All of that is there. Does it go far enough? No. And because I think this is the key part, and not just in Canada, but in the United States, around the world, and how AI is going to interact with copyright protection. So we have yet to see the explosion of AI. And I've been doing this enough to know that it's an industry that sort of falls in love with new technology. The RED camera is going to revolutionize everything. There's going to be less crews, you know, digital from film, green screen, virtual walls. And it hasn't really happened that way. But I think AI is in a different realm. It hasn't happened yet. We've seen some examples in animation where there's been experimentation with AI tools on big budget shows that were a disaster. Didn't work out. Is that a temporary thing? Is that a permanent thing? I don't know, because there's costs associated with all this. Copyright has been the guardrail so far. So just for all the listeners, for all you listeners out there, so to be able to impose copyright protection, it has to be human made. You can't have something that is just mechanically or digitally or by computer made, because that does not afford copyright protection. It has to be a human produced product. And so there is a fear that if AI gets to a certain point, it will not allow studios to protect their product, their end product. And that is a fear, because exploitation of intellectual property rights is how studios make money, right? That's, they keep those the shows in their libraries so they can bring back out in 20 years. I hear X-Files is coming back to Vancouver, so there you go, right? Because they want to be able to exploit the intellectual property rights. But there is no intellectual property rights if it's not man-made or human-made. And that hasn't changed yet. People are looking at copyright protection. Again, how is it going to interface? Because they're looking at copyright, and this is where the labor has to be there, because they say, well, copyright is preventing us from utilizing AI. Right. It is. Because it's about balance use. It's about a tool to assist labor, not a tool to replace labor. That sounds a little trite. It sounds like a jingoism, but there's something to be said for that. I don't think anyone is attacking the concept of a tool that the individual, the labor, controls and makes decisions about whether they want to utilize that tool or not to assist them in carrying out their duties. I don't think that's as much a problem as when a tool is imposed upon a worker without a choice, without an ability to change that reality, and to the point of where they lose their ability to make their product and lose their employment. And it's that fine balance of where that goes. I don't know where it's going to end yet. I just don't. We're an industry that has always, always moved with technology. We've never stood in the way of technology. We made sure we're on top of it. I've said this a few times, but we tell our people right now, you see AI, do it. That's our work. Get on it. Then we can try to control the terms and conditions related to the use of AI. If we don't do the work, if our collective agreements don't cover this work, we don't have an ability to build up protections around that work. It's crucial. We're going to be releasing a program working with locals like 891, telling our members, you got to let us know. You got to call in. When you see it, when you're being asked to use AI tools, if you see AI tools, you got to let us know. Because without that information, we're going to go back to the bargaining table. We need that information. It can't be anecdotal anymore. We need specific examples in what classifications, what occupations, what is being done vis-a-vis AI. We need that information. I know we're doing that in the States right now as we're starting to ramp up for basic negotiations. A key component is we need verification of what AI tools are being used or not. That is crucial as we move forward.
We sent a survey to membership that we're still analyzing the data from, asking those very questions. We had quite a good response from membership. And so it's easier, I think, for members to do that anonymously versus sending case-by-case basis in. But we still do encourage that. And it's interesting because increasingly when Hillary and I go to these AI summits or watching the updates from the literally thousands of newsletters that are based on AI information, the latest, the greatest, the messaging is it's not going to be AI that replaces the human. It's going to be a human who knows how to use AI tools versus those that don't. And so we're about to pilot a new system called Skole AI. It's a startup company based out of Switzerland, and they have tailored tools towards our classifications, our constitution, our agreement, all of that. And, you know, it's not being publicly fed on the outside, but it's designed to give our members the ability to ask the questions, you know, which tools will help make me more efficient, less costly, you know, designed to basically empower our members. They have the choice to use it or not. So that pilot's quickly coming up. We're very excited about it.
But that's a perfect example, Crystal. So it's, I know some people were disappointed when all the unions and guilds, including the IA, did not say you cannot use AI. That should have been our mantle. Mm-hmm. You cannot use AI. That isn't a realistic position to take. It's about making sure that workers have a say in how AI is being used to work with that individual. So the agreements speak about education, about notification, about input from workers before an AI tool is being used, right? And again, am I saying that is the end game? No, it's a start of a conversation. Because without that, you're completely powerless. And now we got to start taking it to the next level sort of thing and try and work out, you know, the myth of, oh, it's being imposed on our members. A lot of times it's our members that are creating their own AI tools and are selling it to the production. And part of the agreement talked about, well, if that does happen, you got to get compensated for that. That's part of the argument as well.
And then if you talk to Dr. Stephanie Dick, it's, you know, the concept of the indignity of training the tool that could actually replace you. There's also that piece too, right? When you're in that situation you're talking about, right? There's just so many aspects to it. And we balance the ethics side of it. Like, where are we getting the critical minerals from? Like, is that ethical? Are we, you know, you can take it as deep as you want to, but we all have to balance this very strange existential crisis that we talk about constantly.
Well, there's an ethical component in this as well. So I've been in meetings with the federal government and with the new ministry that was created for AI and digital innovation. And they're clear, their first mandate is to bring in AI tools that is going to reduce the size of the public sector workforce. It's right out there. They say, we're going to take 40 or 30,000 off the public workforce. And part of the reason we're going to be able to do that is because we're trying to implement AI tools. So that is the first and primary focus of where the federal government's going. Secondly, there's concerns about privacy, transparency, and there's going to be some changes to the criminal code. Every time we talk about creative industries, they say, well, we're going to support heritage as they discuss issues of copyright and what necessary changes to copyright to help bring about greater use of AI. But it's interesting because it seems to be a secondary role to heritage. And I'm not against that because I prefer it that way than having the AI minister run it sort of thing. But it's kind of interesting, right? So their primary focus right now is how can we use AI to reduce the public sector workforce? Read into that what you will.
I definitely am taking the role of bad cop Debbie Downer in this conversation, I can tell. But
I thought I was just being the bad cop Downer
oh,
there.
I'm coming for that position because I hear the pragmatism and I hear the intent of protecting the work and taking that intentional stance of that it's not practicable to say no one can use AI. That ship has well sailed. However, in terms of the survey that we did with members who have contacted us, there is the undeniable, like, do members who have had their work stolen or who have had their work scraped and who have well-documented proof, not just our members, but creative individuals across the world and academics, but the members that we know of, do they just become collateral damage in the bigger moving forward of this? Because for every situation of, yes, go and do the work because then it remains ours and we move with it, all of that comes at a cost of those workers' IP. Because you're talking about how companies are making money off their IP. But we have workers who you can go into Midjourney and say, give me art in the style of so-and-so, and it's their name, their body of work. How do we balance that?
Well, most of our workers don't own their IP, don't own their final product, right? That is the economic transaction takes place. We get hired at the final goods are owned. The intellectual property rights are those that belong to the studios, not to us. I would say the prompts, and I think this is going to become an industry of prompts. It's the prompts. I would argue the prompts are the ownership of the worker. And that is what, that is their creative tool. The final product is not, whether it's using AI or in any capacity, with some limited exceptions, we don't own the final product. That we do not have ownership, unlike like writers and unlike some other groups, we don't. But the prompts, the creative tools to get to that is ours. And you're right, this goes for anything though. You can negotiate the strongest agreements. If you don't enforce it, they don't mean anything. I don't know how many times I've had discussions with local unions say, we need this new language, this, this, and this. I said, well, what does the existing language say? Well, it seems to say the same thing. Yeah, but we haven't done anything with it. Well, isn't that the issue? Like, it's about enforcement of language, not just negotiating new language, but it's enforcing the language you already have. And that is, you have to be willful, you have to be strategic, and it's a commitment because it's not cheap to enforce collective agreements. It's not, and especially in this realm where you're going to be making new law in terms of, you know, the scope of what is your ownership in terms of the product that you delivered and the steps to get to that end product, the prompts that you made, your creative input. And that's, I think, it's what being scraped now. It's that creative element that's being scraped. And so it has to be about enforcement. And then again, we need to know what is being done. It's hard to ask the union to do that. It's the membership that has to do that. They have firsthand knowledge of it. It's just difficult to ask the steward's office or the business agent's office, you know, what AI is being done. You got to be on the ground. You have to see it firsthand to see what's being done, what's being discussed, what is being contemplated, what isn't being contemplated, that sort of thing. But it's about enforcement. But that goes for anything. We bargain these great agreements. We sometimes forget about enforcement of those agreements mm-hmm. and enforcing it on our members too, because sometimes they're equally complicit in violating the agreement for whatever reason. You know, we got to be... We have to be strong in that, and we have to be strategic in that. And in terms of AI, it's no different. I think there's other elements happening as well. I don't think anyone's gotten their head around the energy consumption, the environmental impact of what we're talking about. It's sort of this like afterthought, but the more I read, it's not just an afterthought. It's an absolute, has to be front and center because there's going to be incredible demands in terms of environmental costs associated with this as well.
So, John, you've given so much to the IATSE, to the IATSE. What have you gotten from your experience over the decades you've been dedicated to this work?
I love getting up and I love going to work every morning. Even this morning when I had to fly out to Vancouver at a very earlier hour, it was good. I love our members. Let me tell you who I really love. So we have big unions, and we have a lot of small unions. We call them kitchen counter locals, right? No one is a full-time officer. There's not enough money for that. Everything that gets done is on a volunteer basis. They do the work at their kitchen counter. Before they go to work, after they go to work, they got to make those phone calls. They got to look at, you know, the Constitution. They got to deal with all this stuff. No one pays them for a dime. If that doesn't motivate you, I don't know what will. And, you know, it's sometimes like, oh, why'd you take so long to get back to me? Well, I had a show I did. It was the only work I had this month. And it's like, oh, okay, you know, take your time. That's more important. So that motivates me. Our membership motivates me. It can be frustrating. I always tell, so there's two things I always tell newly elected officers. It's a marathon, not a sprint, right? You come off the floor, you're used to working crazy hours, these short, you know, impactful projects. You come into a position like yours, Crystal, it's every day, it's the same thing, right? And if you're doing this like a sprint, you're going to burn out very quickly. So you got to back off a little bit and let it come to you a little bit in terms of where you go. So you got to look after yourself in terms of how you do that. And to be strategic, you know, we sometimes we jump in with both feet before we kind of figure out where we're going with it. Sit back a little bit and follow our membership. We got some pretty smart people. When you sit in the office, you hear the complaints a lot. You hear about the disenfranchised. You hear about people that feel they didn't get a fair share. I always tell new officers, make sure you spend time to get out on sets. And you see people where they're happy, where they're creating, and where they're using their skill set, these incredible skill sets that our members possess. I get a lot of joy out of that as well. I don't like to use numbers too much, but I look at the influence of our organization. It's more than it's ever been. Our numbers, very few unions are growing, and we're growing exponentially every year. We've been hugely successful in organizing. We've taken on some big gains in animation and visual effects. We're about to, you know, secure an agreement with DNEG, the largest visual effects company in the world. We have a big operation in Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. We're going to have a first agreement by law. Last week, we just have a tentative agreement with the largest independent animation company in Canada, very large, based in Vancouver. That's in addition to two other very large animation companies. So we're really making grounds. We have a big organizing drive and a big broadcast company. Gaming, people are coming to us. You know, we've been very nimble. The old days of going to someone's house and talking to them, getting them to sign a card, it's all digital cards now. People are doing, you know, digital organizing campaigns. So we've adapted to that. But the message is always the same. Empowerment, support, and just looking out for people, right? That never goes away. I don't care what you're dealing with. So we may have these very fancy electronic tools and digital tools, but it still comes down to a one-to-one relationship and making sure people know they got your back. And that's what we're about. So, and we'll continue to do that. It can be frustrating at times. We have, you know, employers that are getting smarter in terms of how they want to take us on. We have governments that, you know, come and go, and some are supportive and some not so supportive. But as long as we maintain our focus on our members, I think we'll be okay.
I will say, as a member and as an official, you and folks like Julia Neville, now retired, such anchor points for newly elected people or even members. And that's so important to be able to kind of tie yourself back to like some sort of grounding home base that has the institutional knowledge that you can lean on and oh my God, this is a crisis, help, and you're there. And so it's been through doing this work that I've really come to understand just how important the Canadian office, the international office's work really is at keeping all of this afloat in a way that's sustainable and that will help families in the future, help workers in the future, help legislation in the future. So
I know we're going long, but can I just add one thing as well? Because there, you know, in light of everything that's going on with Trump and some of the friction between the two countries, so our department is operating. One of our themes this year is Canadian sovereignty, but international solidarity, right? And so we're one of the few unions. We're multinational. We're in two countries. In fact, our members work all over the world. But I see that as a badge of honor. I see that as an absolute positive, because our employers work in that way. Particularly in the motion picture industry, the stuff that we have done with the motion picture department that's based out of LA, in terms of securing agreements in Canada, no U.S. studio. And like even in B.C. where, you know, we have, the B.C. master agreement, but we all know the vast majority of that work is actually in non-exclusive jurisdiction. The studios don't have to use us, but they do. One is because we have the greatest, you know, we have the greatest crews. But they know they're going to be in a lot of trouble if they don't. And so using that is so important. So I couldn't imagine trying to do this without that support with our colleagues and kin in the United States. and working together, particularly in the motion picture industry, it's been incredible. Some of our biggest successes has been because of that. Look at the AI language. Quite frankly, we didn't even really have to negotiate it this last round. We were given the language that was provided for the Hollywood Basic and the Area Standards. Same with Toronto. They got the same language as BC did. That, to me, is a great example. We didn't have to spend 6 months banging it out. We got the benefit of that deal. So we put the I in international, and we put the I in the IATSE, right? So it's been a tough time lately. I don't recognize the government to the south of us right now. Every day I come away a little bit shocked by what I'm hearing and seeing. I'm not even talking about their own internal politics, but just how they're reacting to Canada and Canadians. But I try to like put that in one category, and I look at working people, and we still have the same issues, and we still have the same areas that bind us together. And I think that will continue. And I think as and within the IA, that is doubly so.
Well, thank you, John. That was fulsome and educational, and you're just always a pleasure to speak with. Thank you.
I'm going
to
start wearing these headphones all the time because I love how I sound in these headphones. It's really good. Good job.
Thanks
thank
for
you.
Joining
Quite
us.
Enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Good.
Apple Box Talks is an IATSE 891 production and is recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples. The podcast is hosted by Business Representative Crystal Bronworth and Assistant Business Representative Hilary Bergshaw, and produced by Quentin Benetti. For more episodes, check out ourwork.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Apple Box.